It's been, obviously, a few weeks, but last time when we were looking and continuing, as we have kind of been going through this little series of sorts that we were calling Working Hard or Hardly Working, we were looking at the subject, as we've gone through, of belief and baptism and now talking about what you do as a child of God, as the title kind of implies. Are we working hard or are we hardly working? Are we taking in all the blessings of God and just feasting them upon ourselves, or are we using them as God intended for us to use them? And so we go into, and what I want to do is kind of continue in what we talked about last time, which was, again, the persevering, the continuing in good works, and looking at the subject of good works and what that is and what it means. We kind of hit some things, and as I was thinking back on what I'd said, I realized that I was almost like three separate rail cars going three separate directions, and so hopefully, and I never linked them back up, so they're just careening down the hill at this very moment, and hopefully today I can kind of bring those things back together and link them back together, but two verses that I want us to read real quick to just jot down, keep in your mind as we're going through this. Two verses that I meant to get to last time and didn't, but they really do frame up what I'm trying to get at with all of this. So the first one's from Luke chapter 12 and verse 48, and it goes like this. But he that knew not and did commit things worthy of stripes, and I know we're jumping in the middle of it, but just bear with me, shall be beaten with few stripes. For unto whomsoever much is given, of him shall much be required. And to whom men have committed much, of him they will ask the more. So the statement made there by Christ, and he's giving it in the form of a parable, and it's at the end of the parable, but the gravity statement that he has that I want us to grasp is, to whom or to who a lot has been given, to who a lot has been blessed, to who a lot has been bestowed upon, undeserving, they are required, expected, anticipated that much should be gotten out of them. Okay, if I put a lot of time into working out, I expect results. Okay, the reason I don't work out is because I never get them, and so that's why I just avoid it altogether. Okay, now, if I put a lot of time, though, into working out, I expect results. If I do 100 sit-ups a night, I expect to have the six-pack abs that every movie star and everybody has. That's what I expect. Like I said, I have never done 100 sit-ups a night and never will because, again, it requires too much. But to him that has been committed, the same they will ask a lot of. If you have been blessed, if we've been given a lot, it is expected that we should be doing a lot. We talk about math sometimes, and you know I'm not a big fan of it, but it exists. And we've got to abide by some of these rules. And so math is one of those things that, you know, if you put 1 + 1 in, you expect how much to come out? 2. Every time. And amazingly, it still happens every time. You put 1 + 1, you're going to get 2 out. And we expect that, okay? I'll give you another good example. If I put $100 in the bank, guess how much I expect to get out? 100. Now, if we're talking about a savings account, I expect some extra on top of that. And if you're talking about being young and financial planning and all these good things, and I highly recommend a very good financial planner, ask me later. But if you're talking about financial planning, when you're starting off young, their whole thing is that you want to put everything in the most you can, as young as you can, because there's this magical phenomenon called compounding interest. And it's this beautiful thing that when you take $100 and you multiply, and I'm going to throw out math out here that's not real math, okay? But you're going to get the gist. If you put in $100 and you get 10% off of that, and now you've got $110, well, then 10% of 110 is a little bit more, isn't it? I mean, even I know that. So when I get 10% now of 110, I'm getting a little bit extra. And then when that rolls over a little bit more, I'm getting a little bit more. And it's this magical compounding interest that if you're putting in a lot when you're young, over the years as you grow into that beautiful old age of retirement, it's going to be compounded much more than if I say got started when I was 45, okay? But my anticipation is that if I put more in, I'm going to get more out, right? That is a law. It's just scientific, mathematical, and ecumenical, whatever you want to say. It works every time. Luke 16, verse 10. He that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much. And he that is unjust in the least is unjust also in much. Now, this is a parable, and this is a story that I don't have time to get into, but this is talking about a man who has to kind of work his way out of a very sticky situation, and he does it in a way that somehow gets him out of it, okay? But what the principle he's getting out of this, if you're faithful in what you're doing, you also expect, if you're faithful with a little, you're expected to be faithful with a lot. Faithful, if you're unjust with a little, then the same rules apply. And this is the point of it. If therefore ye have not been faithful, or if you have not been faithful, as it's going to say unrighteous mammon, if you're using a KJV, which is a really easy way of just saying money, okay, natural money. If you're not faithful with natural worldly money, then who will commit to you to trust in the true riches? And so what he's saying there is this. If you can't even handle your money well, your natural job earned or whatever money, if you don't know how to handle that, why do you think God is going to trust with you the riches of the kingdom of God? Now, did we get what he just said by that? And if you have not been faithful in that which is another man's, who shall give you that which is your own? What he is saying here is that if you can't handle, and this is a bigger teaching, bigger principle, and don't have time to get into it completely, we're going to try to hit at it some, but the principle that you get out of this is, if basically what God is saying, if I bless you with money from your job, and you then turn around and blow that money on everything but me, why do you think I'm going to bless you anymore spiritually, with spiritual riches, with the blessings of the kingdom of God? Why do you think I'm going to give you more of that when you can't even handle your money well that I've given you? So if I'm going to take my money and blow it on myself for my reasons and my purposes and think all about me, and yes, Lord, thank you for the job, thank you for the blessings, thank you for the bonuses, thank you for the income, the increase, the interest, whatever, thank you for all that, and all that I'm going to turn right back around and I'm going to pour it back on myself because I'm important, I deserve it, I've worked hard, and I need it. If I'm constantly thinking about myself with the money that God has given me, the money that God has blessed me with, why do I think God is going to reward, bless, or increase my spiritual riches, which is what really nurtures and feeds the child of God? And the principle he teaches here is he won't. So as we continue with that, and we're talking about the subject of good works and perseverance and kind of building out, last time we were here, we talked about the root cause of it all, the thing that was the motivating factor of sorts for Jesus Christ, which was compassion, that he just, it's just who he was. He was compassionate. Compassionate on everybody he came in contact with. He's healing lepers. He's healing blind men. He's healing sick women. He's healing, he's bringing people back from the dead. He's just, you know, he's walking down a road of sorts, and a older woman who had her last son, who would have been her sole provider, the last chance she had, has died, and is now she's walking hopelessly alongside him. What am I going to do? Where am I going to go? How am I going to get money? Because in that society, it just wasn't there. That's why you hear all this about fatherless and widows. You had to have that male person to kind of provide. And Jesus said, not going to have it. Touch the bower, wake the kid up. Kid wakes back up. You know, he's dead. Now he's alive again. Just those are what, that's what Christ did. And he did it because he had compassion. I quoted at a verse that I wanted to go back and make sure we all got, because I think it's just a marvelous verse. And I want us all to write it down and commit it to memory. Micah 7:18. Who is a God like unto thee, that pardoneth iniquity and passeth by the transgression of the remnant of his heritage? He retaineth not his anger forever, because he delighteth in mercy. Now, we talk about all the attributes of God, and of course you can go over to 1 John and we'll read, God is love, okay? I'm reading a real interesting book called Ethics by Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was a German who was imprisoned for his beliefs. But he wrote a lot of good stuff. And in this book, he makes that point about God is love. And he does a very beautiful way of doing it. But making the point, it's not that God exhibits love. It's not that God exhibits the human condition called love. It's that the only real love that exists in existence is God. Okay? God is the embodiment of love. He is love. Everything he does comes out of love because he is love. Okay? So the same thing with this. He delights in mercy. He delights in showing mercy. He delights in showing grace. He delights in showing compassion. And that's what we find with Christ. And we, if we're talking about this and talking about who we are as Christians, okay, that would be people who profess, they believe, and follow after Jesus Christ, okay? So if we identify Christ as being a delighter in mercy, a lover of compassion, then it just makes sense that we would be the same way, right? If I, and we've used this example before, but we'll use it again. If I say I'm an Alabama fan, but I root for Auburn all the time and never root for Alabama, never go to an Alabama game, don't wear Alabama clothes, don't wear, you would go, well, are you really a fan of Alabama, athletics? Well, it'd be hard to tell, wouldn't it? Well, no, I'm a fan. I'm telling you, I'm a diehard fan. Well, but you don't really do anything. You don't really support them. You don't really even, you don't wear their clothes. You don't have the Alabama sheets or the socks or the hats or whatever else that can spawn out of that. You don't have any of that stuff. You don't wear anything Alabama. You don't go to any of the games. You don't act anything like an Alabama fan would. So why would I believe that you are an Alabama fan? Well, because I say so. Well, I almost want to go, well, whoop-de-doo. It's not by what you say, it's by what you do. It's your actions. It used to be, again, out of this book that I'm reading, there was this phrase that we've all heard, or at least we've read over it, that Christ states about the man when the disciples are going out and they're starting to do all sorts of stuff with Christ and they're doing all these miraculous things, and they see the man who wasn't quote unquote part of their group, who was healing in the name of Christ, and they come back and they say, Lord, we rebuked him because he was not with our group. He's not one of the cool kids. He's not one of the ones that you talked about, and he's doing stuff in your name, and we told him to stop it. And what did Christ tell him? Christ said, don't rebuke him, because no man can do a miracle or a good work in my name and not be of me. And he says, if anyone who is, and this is, I hate, because all I can think of now is George W. Bush on this, but if you're with us, you're not against us. If you're against us, you're not with us. And that was basically Christ's answer to them. If you are with me, if you're doing things for me, if you're doing good works in my name, you can't be against me. It's contrary. You're actually doing things for me. In the same way in reverse, and it used to be one of the new church kind of, not induction ceremonies, but kind of litmus test almost. You're either for me or you're against me, okay? So somebody could profess all they wanted to. Oh yeah, sure, I believe in Jesus Christ. Are you doing, working, living, and acting like Jesus Christ? Because then I know you're with us. If not, all I can assume is you're against us. No matter how much you say that you're for us. And there was all in the latter writings of the apostles, you had all these people that were described as being these lovely little sheep or lovely little wolves in sheep clothing that liked to come on in, and they would talk the talk and everything. But then as they started getting a little bit more deeper and infiltrating, well, they start leading you off and getting you to the side and getting you away from Christ. And then they start putting things out there like, well, Christ really, he didn't really raise from the dead, or he's already come back the second time. And we're all just doing this kind of for nothing. All those things started coming into the church towards the end of the Bible as we see it. And they're all things getting right back to that. What is your action? Because your action tells us what you really believe. So we find that with Christ, he is compassionate. We find that compassion should be the mark of why we do good works. We're doing them because God, number one, as we have said over and over again, God made us to do this. Okay, we are created, we're designed, we're the model 2.0. This is us. We're created, formatted, we've been given the will and to do of his good pleasure. We've been made for the purpose of doing good works. That is our job, our function, our role. That's what he's created us to do. And so we talked about with that then the whole kind of the background of why we do the good works, the things that we do here in this world, if we look at Christ as our ultimate example, he did them for glorifying God and having compassion. We talk about the Good Samaritan, like we did last time. And we kind of looked at how what he did. And we focused in on, because of his compassion, his response to the situation of the man that was beat up, half dead, lying in a ditch, was to move and give his money, his time, and his effort in getting that guy out of there, getting him healed up, bandaging him up, leaving a little money extra to take care of any incidentals, and the principle of, I'm coming back. This isn't a one-time deal. This isn't a drive-by compassion, okay? This is something I'm seeing this through. I care about this person so much that when I get back from my job, I'm coming back by. I'm going to make sure he's still doing well. Why? Why do that? This is a complete stranger. Some guy that got beat up on the side of the road. Why do that? What impelled and what moved this guy to do that? We talked about the goodness of the Samaritan did not come because he decided, well, I'm just going to be nice today to some guy. The goodness that was within him came from God. It was the Spirit of God in him moving with compassion on this guy, just like Christ moved with compassion on the multitude of people that he healed. But he gave his time, gave his money, gave his effort. We looked at Deuteronomy 14 and we talked about the tithing. And the reason that we brought that up that I didn't really get to get into was what you saw with the tithing in Deuteronomy 14 was God establishing a principle. And this was what the principle was. We see provision on both sides of that tithing scenario. If we looked back at Deuteronomy 14 and recapped at what we talked about, there was two sets of provisions laid out. One of them was that at the beginning of, let's say, the week, you were to take 10% of what God had prospered you, and you're to take it to the church or the synagogue or the local communion area, and you're to give it to that area around a feast where everybody gathered and everybody rejoiced and ate of the prospering that God had given them in that week before. But also, you were to have a set aside portion of that for the widows and the fatherless and the Levites, okay? And then there was a yearly or an every 3 year thing where you came and you gave 10% of what you'd been prospered. And you gave that for the caring of the widows, the need or the widows, the fatherless, and the foreigners, okay? So we talked about those who were not citizens of that country. God made provision for them as well, okay? Hint, hint, nod, nod, wink, wink. Everybody pay attention to that, okay? Because as we said before, you're not a Christian because you're a Republican. And you're not a Christian because you're a Democrat. You're a Christian because you follow Christ. And there was already provisions hundreds of years ago for people who didn't look the same way, act the same way, talk the same way, or whatever else. But what we see is the provision on both sides. The way that it was laid out was God said, you over here, who I have blessed, I want you to take 10% of all the increase that I've blessed you with, and you're to take it over, and then it's going to be distributed to these people over here who do not have that source of provision. They either don't have a husband to provide, they don't have a father to provide, they don't have a citizenship to provide, they're destitute, they have no provision for them. This is my provision for them. So God was providing for them because he provided for them over here. So if you're looking at me on the radio, left side and right side. So he provided for those who had the resources. He provided increase in the crops, increase in the goods and the selling and all that. He blessed them with that. So people would say, oh, this year God has blessed us exponentially. And God said, yes. And because you recognize that I have blessed you in that, take 10% of it, and I want you to put it over here for all those people who have not been blessed in that similar way. And what you are blessed with will now become a blessing for them. Do we catch that? What he did not say was, over here, with all you who I've blessed, and you've seen increase, and you've seen blessings of your goods, and selling, and all this stuff, and you've got it all, and you've got your bonuses, and you've got your quarterly bonus, and you've got your interest, and whatever. Take all that, go do whatever you want to with it. In fact, you know what? You worked so hard, you earned this. Take a week off, take that money, go buy whatever you want, go do whatever you want, live however you want. I know I've blessed you with it, but just go have fun. He didn't say that, did he? It's not there. Because his providing of a blessing on them was to be used back in glorying of God. Okay? you take what God has blessed you with on this side and you're just turning it right back around, 10% of it at least in that case, and returning it to God, saying, God, and this is the benefit of it. It benefits these people over here who are destitute and don't have that provision, and it also benefits the ones over here who are giving, because when they realize that they didn't get it because they're just so cool or they're just so hardworking or they're just so American and studious, but that they got it because God actually gave it to them, then it breeds humility in realizing this isn't mine anyway. Why would I keep this and feast it upon my own lust? It's not mine. I didn't earn this. God blessed me with it. It's a reorganizing of our priorities and in our mindset, because all too often in our mindset is, I worked hard, I did the extra shift, and this is mine, and this is what I'm going to keep. And I'm going to take it, and I'm going to use it for me. Now look, this is in no way, shape, form, or fashion blasting some kind of, you know, like I want us all to have some kind of ascetic mindset where we sell all of our goods and we all live in rags and we walk around and we don't ever keep anything to ourselves and we have a guilt trip if we get, I mean, that is not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about never going on vacation. I mean, hello, come on. I'm not talking about don't get a new car, okay? You know, when that thing's falling down and breaking and you're, you know, riding, your feet are scuffing the bottom of the ground as you're driving, and I mean, yes, you can get a new car. What I'm saying is, if you're taking what God has given you and you're feasting it upon yourself while starving the church and who the church is to be helping, then yes, your priorities are mismatched. If you just want that new car because you want the Bluetooth, super enabled, supercharged, you know, midnight blue or whatever, your car may be working fine, but that's what you want. And, you know, yeah, I know it's going to mean that for the next 6 months, I'm not going to be able to give anything to the church. Your priorities are off. We're going to get into, and I know because there's thoughts and there's old mindsets about giving to the church that we're going to address, probably not today, but just bear with me and stay with me because we're going to get to it. Okay. But in this, we have the idea, you take what God has prospered you, and the number that he used in the Old Testament was 10%. You can give more, that would be great, okay? But he gave you a nice little number, 10%. You take the 10% of what God has prospered you, and you return it back in an offering of sorts to God, saying, I recognize that this is from you. It's not really mine to begin with. Have you ever heard, whenever you've had any kind of schooling on saving or anything like that, and we probably all have, but anytime you have any kind of schooling on saving, what do they tell you to do? Just go ahead off your check. Have it, if they've got it where it will come off your check before it ever gets in your bank account, go ahead and just take that on off of there. Because then you'll be like, well, it's not even mine anyway. I don't even notice it's there because it's off my check before it ever hits my bank account. So I don't remember it. I don't realize it's there. I don't see it. I don't miss it because I'm going off what root number I'm taking home. Just go ahead and have it skimmed off. You know, put 10, 12% in your 401k. Why? Because it's going to come off there. I'm not going to see it. I'm not going to have to take that money and put it over here because that would be too hard for me to do and probably it's not going to happen. So they tell you just to go ahead and do that because why? They want you to think it's not even yours. Don't think like you've got it. Don't think like it's there. Let it go off into your 401k and then you'll retire and you'll be a billionaire, which is what my financial planner promised me. But the mindset was there, it's not yours. Don't let it hit your bank account and think that it's yours. Because if you think that it's yours, you're going to take it and you're going to go out there and you're going to buy that next DVD, that next PlayStation game, that next Xbox game. You're going to go whatever, you know, spend it on more Alabama gear, you know, whatever it may be. You're going to waste that money instead of returning it to God like we're supposed to. So as we're thinking about all this, this is the verse that revolved around in my head over and over and over and over and over again as I'm thinking about this subject. In Mark chapter 12 and verse 29, this is after one of the scribes asked Jesus, which was the first commandment of all? And Jesus answered him, the first of all commandments is, Hear, O Israel, which that means us too, the Lord our God is one Lord. And thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind and with all thy strength. This is the first commandment. Did you catch all the alls? This is a verse that he did not say with 10%. Okay? Catch all the alls. With all of your all, with everything you've got, love God. No negotiating of that.
Not if it's convenient, not if it feels right, not if you're in the mood, not if... Love God. And the second is like, namely this. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Now, this is what I want everybody to roost on. There is none other commandment greater than these. There is no other commandment greater than these. Now, sometimes when you get on these things that are kind of what we would call practical godliness or things that seem so simple and so, oh, that's so elemental Christian, you know, you're not using any big words like justification or sanctification or, you know, you're not doing anything grandiose and you didn't have to have a degree to learn that, you know. Of course we know we love God and we love others. That's so simple. You need to be focusing on doctrine. Make sure you're getting deeper into doctrine and make sure you're understanding more doctrine and theology and philosophy of all these things so that you can spout off big words and sound eloquent in all your Christian living and all this. He says there's nothing greater than these two things. And here's the problem. It's a doctrine. And you know what? We fail at it. Before you ever get justification nailed down, which if you ever do to 100% and you can get all the verses and just explain them to a T without ever stuttering, you just come and preach to me any day you want to. But you get justification down. You can't do it without these two verses, okay? Because it's these verses that mean everything about why we were justified in the first place. You can't get sanctification down if you're not loving God and loving your neighbor as yourself, loving others. You can't do it because part of sanctification here in this world with us is being more like Christ. And Christ nailed this, okay? So you cannot get any deeper in doctrine if we're failing at this elementary, rudimentary thing, okay? And we are failing at it. We can get all day long and go on and on about, you know, we could have all sorts of justification, sanctification, all these different kind of ifications, and we can get it all nailed down, and we can get all this doctrinal whatever, and we can argue doctrinal theological principles and go back and forth all you want to. But we are failing at loving God and loving other people. You know, we say, well, Adam, why do you say that? How do you know that? And this is how I know it. All you have to do is flip on the TV, or flip on Facebook, if you want to. I wouldn't necessarily recommend it all that much. That's why I don't get on Facebook a whole lot. I get on there to post pictures of my kids and show everybody how cute they are and how jealous you should be. But, you know, otherwise I'm not too interested because here's the thing. Never fails. And this is what we kind of talked about this last time. We were talking about the incidences with the shootings of between the policemen and the African Americans that we've talked about on those two different occasions. We talked about this immediately. First step, first reaction that you'll see on Facebook, mostly by people who live thousands of miles away from the event, have never grown up in a situation like that, have never been around or involved or done anything with anything like that. But the main stamp behind their name is whatever, Republican or Democrat. Their immediate response will be some kind of preformed reactionary response. Okay? And if they and a lot of the ones that I read around those times profess to be Christians. And one of the main tenets, no greater commandment than these, was to love your neighbor. So whether they were, you know, we kind of talked about this. Yes, there are facts. And yes, facts are great. And yes, facts do mean something. But the Bible, the Gospels, the Apostles all warned us. There's a time to weep with those who weep, and there's a time to rejoice with those who rejoice, regardless of circumstance. He didn't put a caveat on that. He didn't say, well, only weep with them if the facts are there, okay? If they have a factual, legitimate reason to be weeping, then you can weep with them and show compassion. But, you know, if the facts don't check out, or whether they're a Democrat and you're a Republican, well, it's not necessarily that, you don't have to be that interested. Or if you feel philosophically and from your political viewpoint, that this person, you know, we'll use this because it was part of the tithing example. You know what? They didn't get into this country like they were supposed to. So we had the tithing for the foreigners in Israel. Well, they didn't get here like they were supposed to. So now, because they disobeyed a law, which is legitimate, but because that, whatever the reasons, whatever the purposes are, why ever they're here, in a lot of cases I found, if you get to the story of actually why they're here, I'm not justifying illegalities, but if you get to the story why they're here, you'll find out the story is pretty heartbreaking. They're not here because they wanted to steal a janitorial job from somebody. They're usually here because they wanted to get money to send back to their kids who are being run out of their town because drug dealers just killed or hung their sister or cousin or brother. The situations are there. Whatever it may be, the predication for the Christian is not looking out and saying, well, you know, I could show you compassion, but you know, you didn't really get here the right way. If you go back to home, go back to your drug dealing, cartel, killing, murdering place. Go back there, come back in the right way, and then open arms. We'll be the most loving Christian people that we could ever be. You can go back and you can look through history, and we've read this. There's history on all sides. You go to the West Coast and you have people over there wanting to kill and murder, you know, Chinese people. You go up in the North and you have whatever situation, Irish people that they want to beat up and abuse. You come down here, we may have black people that we want to beat up and abuse. Over the history, the course of this, there's been Christian professing, and I'll use professing, wrapped up in all of it. People will go to church on Sunday and a lynching on Saturday night and somehow justify it. There is no greater commandment than these. You love God and you love your neighbor. If we can't get that, the rest of everything we profess as Christians is bogus. That's why you have so many people, and I know there are some cases that I tell them, well, you're actually wrong about that, but so many people, if you've ever heard, well, Christians are just a bunch of hypocrites. Well, you know, in some cases I'll go, you know, you're not right. What you're talking about, yes, we do profess this, and yes, it is hypocritical because we say that we shouldn't be doing these things, and some of us still struggle with that. Unfortunately, a lot of that is we're struggling with it, but we're still coming to the cross because we recognize we still need help with it. Unfortunately, in other cases, what you have is exactly legitimate hypocrisy, and the same biblical hypocrisy you would see with the Pharisees or whoever, where you have people who profess loving your neighbor as yourself and walking out the next door the next day and treating somebody absolutely inhumane. Going out and going to your Starbucks and just absolutely blasting the person who is giving you your latte because they didn't get it with soy milk instead of whole milk, okay? Sunday morning, loving Jesus, amazing grace, how sweet the sound. Monday morning, I can't believe you did this, you're so stupid. You shouldn't exist, you need to quit. I'm calling your corporate office, how ignorant of you to make a mistake. Because I know I never make a mistake. I don't have these kind of problems. I know that I am perfect. And when we roll back around the next Sunday, I'm going to go into church with that same attitude. We walk out of here professing to be lovers of our neighbors and then walk out and hate and abuse our neighbors. Well, hypocrites. Give it to me. I will take that label then. So how are we failing to love God and love others? We kind of talked about this a little bit just then. I want us to look at Acts chapter 2 because the deal is that if you want your example, okay, then we probably need to go to the example that the first church gave us. And in Acts chapter 2, this was the first, I like to label it as the first corporate action of the established church, okay? The first kind of thing that happened after the church took off on the day of Pentecost. Now, obviously, large church, big view church, you know, Christ came on and brought the kingdom, okay? This is what I'm talking about with the group of believers banding together and finally, you know, walking out the doors as a quote-unquote church. Acts chapter 2, this is what you have in verse 44. And all that believed were together and had all things common, and sold their possessions and goods and parted them to all men, as every man had need. And they, continuing daily with one accord in the temple, and breaking bread from house to house, did eat their meat with gladness and singleness of heart, praising God and having favor with all the people. And the Lord added to the church daily such as should be saved. So the first action we have of the church as a corporate entity, you have them walking in, coming together. They have sold everything they've had, and they take what they sold and they divide it amongst every man that had need, which means that everyone there, regardless of their background, their history, their political views, their racial color, whatever it may be, if you had a need, then the church as a corporate entity was filling that void and taking care of you. And they were willingly, gladly, and joyfully selling all that they had to do that. Now, they also praised God, okay? In with that. It's mixed together. And that's, you know, sometimes when we talk about the church and its function and its role, and again, we're going to kind of get into this, but sometimes when we talk about the church function, sometimes we stop it like, well, the church is about worship, and that's it. You know, you come in here, you worship, and you go home. That's what the church is for. But here we see that the church as a corporate body was coming together, giving all that they had because they wanted to see people who had need have their needs met. And in and through all that, they were praising God. It's a connection of those two commandments that Christ was talking about. You're loving God and you're loving your neighbor. These are the two greatest commandments, and there's nothing that can top them because they go together hand in hand. Your love of God, your being a born-again child of God, you're having the Spirit of God dwelling in you means that you have that spirit of compassion that Christ had, which means that it's going to eventually bubble up and come out onto somebody else. That you're going to love other people if you're truly loving God. And so here you see the church in this action. They're moving out, they're praising God, they're selling all that they have, they're making sure people are taken care of. And we understand that we fail this most of the time because we're too busy feeding it upon our own selfish desires. We're failing this in like the giving of our money. Why? Because as we spoke of earlier, we're taking our money, and when we get that extra, oh yeah, boy, that's just more that I can go get another Xbox game. I can go get another PlayStation game. I can go take care of me. I can go get myself pampered. I can go take care of myself. You know, I could give that extra to the church, but you know, I still got, you know, it's one of those things. I got to have my me time. I got to do my me thing. I got to take care of me so that I can feel better about myself. Or the giving of our time. Same thing. Well, and now you think back to the story of the Good Samaritan. He gave his money. He gave his time. He gave his love. Okay? He took money and literally provided for the man. He took the time that he was obviously a businessman or a traveler of sorts. He took time out of his day, out of his busy money selling, you know, wheeling and dealing schedule to pick up this guy, load him up on a donkey, run him into town, put him in a hotel, bind up his wounds, pay for his, and then come back. Well, I'm sorry. I don't have the time. I mean, yeah, I got some. And if I don't do it now, then if I don't take this time right now for me to get, you know, to do this, then it's never going to happen. And I got to do this for me so that I can feel good and I can have what I want. So we fail in these things because we fail to get off of ourselves and love others. We spend too much time with the commandment being not love your neighbor as yourself, but just love yourself a whole lot. And if your neighbor happens to fall in there, then great. We also fail to love God and others with our worship. And this is, again, we're going to hit these points, not today, but later, in how we come in for worship and what we do in worship. And something that hopefully we'll get to, you know, later about, as I kind of, and you know me, I love little sayings, putting the worship back in worship, okay? That the idea of worship is that it's not about you. It's not about me. It's about God. That's the whole point. That's what the word means. It's not about me. And all too often we come in and we want this my way, and it's got to be this way because this is how I like it for me. And I'm singing this song because it's what I want. And then I'm coming in with this attitude because that's how I feel. And I'm waiting for you to get me out of this attitude because that's what you're supposed to do. And when all these things work, then maybe I'll be happy about the situation. And also because we come in and it's got to look this way traditionally, because this is how traditionally we've done it and this is how we've always do it. And it doesn't matter whether it's not working or the point's not there, or because we're just coming in for tradition and not to actually worship. It's got to be done this way just because that's just how it's got to be done. It's got to be for 30 minutes and you've got to sit, or you can stand at this one psalm, but don't stand at too many, because then you're getting a little Pentecostal. Don't clap your hand, because then you're getting a little bit too evangelical. Don't raise your hand for God's sake and everyone else's, because that's really way out there. Don't do it. You got to look like you're supposed to look, act like you're supposed to act, because that's just how we've always done it. It's a little bit too crazy to do anything otherwise. Well, you know what the source of all that is? Me, 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 me. I'm coming in here for my fulfillment in my way, the manner I want, because it's what I want and how I like it. And everybody else, doesn't matter. You either get with how I want to do it, or this isn't going to work. So next time, as we kind of get into this, didn't get into what the meat of what we wanted to get into today, but next time what we're going to be looking at is how this breaks out in the three different sections, in individuals and in families and as a church, okay? Because as we've said before, it's individuals that make up families. It's families and individuals that make up churches. And so all of them have to be hitting on all cylinders for this thing to work, okay? So in how you love your neighbor and love God as an individual, whether you're married or unmarried, at your job, at school, at home, at wherever it is, that is you can only control you. I can't control you. I can give you all the information. I can't make you do it. Okay. So the individual has to be on board with this. The individual that then makes up a family has to be on board with this, because then you got multiple little individuals with multiple little personalities where they're all little wills. And some of them are really, really strong wills. Okay. Not going to name any names, but some of them are. But you've got all these little individuals that make up families. Well, now these individuals are trying to interact, and they're all trying to continue in this love of God and love of your neighbor as yourself. And that's going to look a little bit different. But then as these families and individuals come together and make up the corporate church, the whole church has to be with one mind, one accord, one vision. Love God, love your neighbors. That is our whole purpose. So hopefully we'll look at these things next time and continue to study on it, and hopefully the Lord will continue to bless.